That cold case you're listening to? Nasty stuff. But you know what else is a crime? Missing even a moment of whatever you're doing to go on a drink run. Luckily, there's Drizly, the number one app for alcohol delivery. With Drizly, you can compare prices on the biggest selection of beer, wine, and spirits, then get them delivered in under 60 minutes. So download the Drizly app or go to drizly.com. That's drizly.com today.
Do me a favor, say, where can I park my car?
I am not saying that because that is, nobody says that. And here's another thing too. Nobody calls Boston Beantown. The only people that do that are the people that are not from there.
Tell it to the Wahlbergs, asshole. That's where I fucking heard it from.
Fuck those guys. Yeah, like, those guys are fucking clowns. Yeah.
I'm talking, hey, Tom Gelati. Did I pronounce the name right?
You did. Wow, that's amazing. Good for you.
Yeah. Hey, you know, I probably should have warned you I was going to get into this, but after your partner Zeus was on the program, I had more than, at least three people ask me if you two were gay. And by the way, based only on comments that he made on that show.
Oh, well, look, I'm just going to refer to Seinfeld and just say, not that there's anything wrong with that. OK, yeah, we shared a lot of time together in college, but we didn't share that kind of time together in college.
I think a couple times he referred to you as his partner, and that probably threw people off. But
yeah, no, show partner, podcast partner, friend when the mics are not on, I guess, put it that way.
Okay. I mean, it never dawned on me until someone asked, and then another person asked. I'm like, so then I went back and actually listened to it. And I'm like, all right, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe, because yeah. I'm like you. I'm like, not that there's anything wrong with that, but I had no idea, you know?
My wife doesn't think we are, so I hope we're good with that, but that's good though.
I have the opposite problem. My wife is convinced I'm gay.
But nice.
Yeah, real nice. Tom, you are the co-host of the Shout It Out Loud cast. We had your partner, not in love but in life, Zeus, back a few episodes ago to talk about the Stone Temple Pilots record Purple. You're on today. We're going to get into Rolling Stones. Coming in at number 17 is the Screaming Trees, Sweet Oblivion. But before we get into that, tell us a little bit about what's going on over there at the Shout It Out Loud cast.
So Shout It Out Loud cast, we are an all Kiss podcast. We release new episodes on Saturday. And at the beginning of this year in January.
Just real quick. Finally, there's a Kiss podcast out there.
It's true. Because we said, you know, there really are no Kiss podcasts out there. We have to fill that void.
Good point.
But we come from the angle of we're lifelong Kiss fans, but we're not serious. If you haven't checked us out, check us out. We're not very serious at all in any way. We love the band, but we have plenty of good times shitting on the band, shitting on the members, the history, some of their music. But we are huge fans. We're diehards. We've seen them a million times with all different lineups. But we're big fans of making fun of them. Some recent episodes, we've had a lot of fun with what we refer to as Pandemic Paul. Because since he's not touring, he's trying to find himself, trying to keep himself busy with just utter silliness on social media. So things like that, we do that. But like I was saying, at the beginning of this year in January, we started to veer off a little bit and do what we call monthly bonus episodes, where we bring in our friend Sonny Hollywood Pooney, and we do album reviews of non-Kiss records. We kind of rotate picking albums that we like. We've done things like Appetite for Destruction, Slide It In, Pyromania, Super Unknown by Soundgarden, Iron Maiden, Peace of Mind, things like that. So we love Kiss, but we love all different kinds of music. So that kind of gave us an outlet to expand what we talk about.
Kiss is a lot of fun to talk about, but if you're going to do a weekly show, it can be a bit, I don't know, it can be a bit much just trying to keep it fresh and all that stuff. But you are probably, don't know. I listen to the Kiss Room a lot, but that's more of a celebration of Kiss just in general. Your show is probably my favorite Kiss podcast. That's more in a podcast format. Matt Porter, of course, does like a monthly radio show that it also goes out in kind of a, you can downloadable fashion,
Yep.
But the Kiss Room, of course, I'm talking about. But those are really the only two that I check out on a regular basis. Beyond that, it kind of depends on the topic. I did like Ken Mills and Julian Gill. And Gary Schaller did that kind of two-part series on Wicked Lester, which I thought it was fascinating. And I'm a guy who's researched this stuff enough to know a lot of what's going on and what they're talking about, and the fact that they dropped a lot of facts I'd never heard, and it was a lot of fun. But for the most part, I've read so many goddamn Kiss books, I've seen so many movies, documentaries, whatever, that there isn't too much out there information-wise that I'm yearning for. But so I like more of the banter and having fun that you guys offer.
Yeah, and like Zeus and I joke about, when you listen to us, you're probably not going to learn a lot. if you want to learn about Kiss, maybe go somewhere else. But seriously, we try to mix it up. Like you said, it can be tough doing things every week, but we do things like top 10. We make up our our pretend live albums. We do different kind of Kiss drafts. We do album, studio album reviews, compilation reviews. So we try to keep it fresh. We try to keep it fun because it is a Kiss podcast, but we try to make it fun and entertaining under the guise of the topic of Kiss.
Yeah, I think you guys do a great job. You know that though.
Thank you.
I kiss
Thank
your
you.
Ass all the time on social media, but
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Well, when I first thought about or basically made the announcement in a podcast group that we're in that, hey, I'm thinking about doing this. Is anybody interested in joining me on this kind of grunge celebration? You were one of the very first people. Not only did you say it, but it was almost like a three word thing. It's like, yes, Sweet Oblivion. Did I read that right? That this is an album that you're very passionate about?
This is an album that I am extremely passionate about. The term that people like to use, Desert Island Disc, this is absolutely a desert island disc for me. Very passionate about this album, very passionate about this genre, and I was glad to be able to be on this because I really don't think there'd be another outlet for me to talk about this album. It certainly probably wouldn't come up in our bonus episodes on Shout It Out Loudcast. So to be able to have an opportunity to talk about this album and kind of explain my passion for it, I'm excited, and that's why I jumped right on it when you posted this.
I hadn't heard this record in full probably since around the time it came out, and it would have been probably like in a party setting or getting together with friends or something like that. So I had never in my life sat down and actually just dissected it like I had this last week. Let's talk a little bit about where you were at in like 91, 92 when grunge kind of started. As we already know that you're a lifelong Kiss fan, this is a bit of a shift away from a lot of that kind of music. What were you listening to like before Nirvana kind of blew up? And then how quickly did you grasp onto grunge?
This is like the perfect storm. So I graduated high school in 91, and that summer Pearl Jam 10 was released. Mm-hmm. And then that fall of 91 is when I started college, met Zeus. And for anybody that listens to our show, our occasional co-host, my buddy Murph, who was my college roommate. So when before grunge kind of took the world over, we were still listening to, Metallica, hair metal was still hanging around, Guns N' Roses, kind of like that late 80s, early 90s, where music, you were kind of getting that tail end of hair metal that was kind of garbage. But you still had bands, like bands like Tesla that was still putting out some good records. So we would listen to that. And then you hear about, Pearl Jam. What is this Pearl Jam? You hear Jeremy on the radio. I get the CD. Back in the day, kids, when people had CDs. So you get the Pearl Jam CD, and that came out in August. And again, we move into college as freshmen, and that was literally the only thing that you heard that entire year. And then it was just on album on top of album. I had heard Nevermind. I had heard Nirvana. But the Pearl Jam album just blew up. And then Stone Temple Pilots Core. And then it was just like a tidal wave. And that's pretty much everything we listened to. Pretty much all through college. It's kind of like the soundtrack of our college years, mm-hmm. which is kind of why Screaming Trees kind of is that sweet spot for me, because that encapsulated this album. And then the fact that we were exposed to Screaming Trees through the single soundtrack, which is also on this Rolling Stone ranking. And a single soundtrack, we still talk about it now. That's pretty much our college soundtrack. We got that when it came out in 92. Listened to it incessantly because it was pretty much a grunge greatest hits album. Had unreleased tracks from Pearl Jam. It had a song from Screaming Trees. It had just great stuff on it. So grunge kind of took over the world. Kiss had released, you know, Revenge during that era. I was a huge fan of Revenge at that time. Huge fan of Metallica was putting out records. From the mid to late 90s, it was pretty much all grunge, and then alternative rock is kind of those bands kind of veered off, and you started getting some of the, you know, some of the girl bands, you know, bands Belly. Like Belly and hey. Belly. Love Belly. My buddy Murph and I, we've seen Belly in concert a couple of times. So bands like Belly, you know, Throwing Muses, Juliana Hatfield 3, like bands like that. So the grunge and alternative kind of really took over for us, especially for me. And then the late 90s, 2000s, you know, right around the time, you know, getting married and all that stuff, that's when I started to kind of revisit and kind of pick the albums that I want to kind of hang on to. Because around 2000, it was like, all right, nothing really good is coming out anymore. I know people don't like to hear that, but, you know, like Zeus and I always joke about, you know, we don't really listen to new music that much. So I find myself coming back to a lot of things in my catalog, and Screaming Trees is an album that I come back to all the time. Like, I listen to it repeatedly.
Well, let's get into that a little bit. It was released on September 8th, 1992. It comes in at a whopping 46 minutes and 13 seconds for 11 tracks. That's solid. And produced by Don Fleming. I didn't, like I said, you know, just a few minutes ago, I didn't really get a chance to digest this record until recently, and it is kind of a forgotten gem. I touched on it on the singles episode. I almost think they were hurt by their song being a hit and on that soundtrack. You know, what do you think of that album cover before we get into the track listing here?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, doing some research for this episode. So I have, I don't know if you or I'm sure your listeners are some of the vinyl geeks, you know, with the resurgence of vinyl. Mm-hmm. So pretty much all my favorite albums I have on vinyl. Screaming Tree, Sweet Oblivion is one of them. So I have a nice giant picture of the album cover. And it is a pretty ridiculous album cover. The back album cover pretty much shows you why they're on the back, because as my co-host Zeus would say, they are not a bunch of handsome men.
No.
You know, the Connor brothers look like a couple of giant lumberjacks. Barrett Martin looks like, you know, he'd be like a late night talk show host, and Mark Lanegan looks like a guy who works at like the local carnival. So, you know, they're not kind of the guys that would make a cover, but the cover of this, is, you know, it's like the control panel of like an old ship. That's what it looks like. It's like right. the rusted control panel of an old ship. I guess that's what I found out in my research. And then in one of the little control portholes or whatever, you have a picture of the band kind of staring up at you. And then over to the right, it says Sweet Oblivion, kind of like in the kind of where like maybe you'd see like a caution sign or something on a control panel. So it's kind of a lame album cover. But, you know, a lot of these grunge guys, they didn't really know what they were doing with album covers, you know, unless you're, you know, Kurt Cobain or Alice in Chains for the most part.
Yeah. OK. But they go back quite a ways. Where does this come in their discography? Is it like third or fourth?
This is their first major label release, I believe, if I'm correct. Oh, with
that
Epic.
Comes in at six. I'm looking at the list now.
Yeah, well, that's the thing about them. They were around in the 80s.
Yeah.
And you know, they were putting records out, and people were kind of getting kind of hip to their sound. Their previous drummer, Mark Pickrell, before Barrett Martin took over, they were very garage rocky, you know, garage mm-hmm. rock, you know, psychedelic 70s classic rock. And we talked about this a little bit before we started recording. When you look at this list, the term grunge really casts a wide net. Mm-hmm. And I think that was a marketing thing so that they could sell these bands to radio stations or to record labels. Like, oh, this is a new grunge band. Because Screaming Trees, yes, they're grungy, but Screaming Trees doesn't sound like Alice in Chains. They don't sound like Pearl Jam. They don't sound like, you know, early Soundgarden. They don't sound like the Melvins. You know, they're their own thing, mm-hmm. but they fall into that grunge thing. And when they kind of were putting their records together, you know, Uncle Anesthesia, the album before this, which was a great, very underrated album. I don't think it made this list. But the record label didn't know what to do with them. I mean, that album, Uncle Anesthesia, before Sweet Oblivion, that was co-produced by Chris Cornell from Soundgarden. Hmm. But it was also co-produced by a guy by the name of Terry Tate, who produced albums by Overkill and Pantera.
Okay.
So that shows you that, and even the record label was kind of putting Screaming Trees in like a metal genre, because at the time they're like, we don't know what to do with these guys, mm-hmm. and that kind of hurt them. They kind of ended up picking up with Epic, signing on and recording Sweet Oblivion, and their record label even told them, this is make or break. You guys need to put together an album that's going to kick ass and sell, or this might be the end of you guys. Unfortunately, they put out another album after Sweet Oblivion, which was called Dust. And that was actually named the album of the year by Kerrang! Magazine, which is weird because Kerrang! Really doesn't cover a band like Screaming Tree. So their career is all over the place. And yeah. I think they suffer sometimes maybe from record label management, production, you know, producers, because you look at an album like this, they could have easily been a huge band like Pearl Jam, like Alice in Chains, like Soundgarden. They could have. They have the ingredients. And I think it just, a lot of bands you see, they just can't succeed, whether it's their own fault or whether it's the management fault.
Barrett Martin officially declined to be interviewed for this episode.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, he said okay. He didn't want to talk about Mad Season or Screaming Trees. So
really? Mm-hmm. Well, because I was going to say, and Barrett Martin, drummer for with Screaming Trees. And Barrett Martin also came from Skin Yard, another early grunge band, too. Mm-hmm. So,
featuring,
you know,
Jack and Dino, who produced a couple of the records, early records of Screaming Trees.
Exactly. You start to hear a lot of these same names in the early ages of the grunge era. And it's funny, too, because Screaming Trees, these guys aren't even from Seattle. They're 100 miles away from Seattle in a completely other part of Washington. But like I said earlier, if you can call somebody grunge and that's the flavor of the month, it's going to help sell. Kind of like all those bands that got wrapped up with the hair metal term, like, oh, this is a new hair metal band. So I think they just suffered from, maybe it was bad management, bad, you know, record label didn't know what to do. It was a confusing time. And I think they came out at a bad time, too. I think they came out riding the, you know, Nirvana was huge, Pearl Jam was huge. And they're like, oh, here's another band.
Yeah.
Which is unfortunate for them.
It's almost like Stone Temple took their place. You know, yeah, like, we can have five, not six.
Yep, exactly.
Yeah, it definitely isn't the music. And I guess I'll start getting into that. The album opens up with a song called Shadow of the Season. From the North Ward down to the valley, in a world of hurting, I'm moving on. Out from the lighthouse, out on the ocean, and climb a mountain, so very tall.
Unbelievable killer opener for me. Starts off very moody. You have that kind of tribal drum beat. You have that grinding guitar sound, kind of that droning sound. Get a little psychedelic there. Then the drums kick in, and then you're introduced to Mark Lanegan's voice,
which
is just spectacular. I mean, his voice is just amazing. And one thing, I'm going to probably say it a lot throughout this album, one of the things that sticks out to me, ever since I was a little kid, I've been obsessed with drums and drumming in general. Barrett Martin on this album is such a standout for me. And this song kind of shows that for me. He's not your typical, you know, drummer where it's, you know, kick drum, snare, kick drum, snare. He fills a lot of that space with some extra kick drums. And it's not overpowering. It's not overbearing. It's not distracting. I think it really adds to the mood of the music. And this song here has that. For me, it's a killer opener. They used to open up their concerts with this, which is a great way to do that. So for me, I'm going to give this 5 sleeveless flannel shirts.
Nice. All right. This is a great, first of all, it's a great album opener. One of the things up to this point that's kind of stuck out is the lack of attention some of these bands seem to pay to sequencing. This record, by the third track, it's clear that there is some effort to actually develop and build an album with a beginning and an end, that kind of deal. So with that said, this is a great opener. The chorus, I don't know if you even call it a chorus, but I love the way he delivers that line. Said, Lord, give me what I need. And by the way, Mark, you can't say enough about Lanegan as a singer. Just that smoky, I assume it's a baritone. But Jesus, I mean, what a voice. And that unique sound alone, to me, was a big calling card for grunge. And that might have been the last musical movement where bands almost instantly were identifiable by their own sound. You know, it seemed like as we got more computerized in our recording process and then more homogenized in like what radio was going to deem acceptable to put on, you turned into a blender where it's now like if we're talking hard rock, it's a combination of Nickelback, Godsmack, and Disturbed. They just kind of blend all that up, and then here's the newest version of that. Topically, is this about drugs? that's a runaway theme with these grunge bands.
I don't know because you know they got the title of the album from this where they talk about, you know, oh sweet oblivion, you know, sweet oblivion feels all right. So Barrett Martin was talking about, you know, they were on such a high, you know, not drug wise, but you know, getting ready to produce the album that was going to hopefully save their career. Mark Lanegan has, you know, noted, you know, drug problems, you know, so it could just be a story about, you know, out from the lighthouse, out on the ocean, can't climb the mountain so very tall. Could just be a general song about struggling or trying to find your way and succeeding. Said, Lord, please give me what I need. Said there's pain and misery. You know, he is pouring out his soul, and you're going to hear that a lot in this album. And his voice makes you believe and feel what he's saying. I don't think there's anything contrived about anything that's coming out of Lanegan's mouth on this entire album. I don't think it's pretend. I don't think he's doing it to sell a record. I think he legitimately believes what he is singing and that passion and that voice that comes out. And like you said, too, I was going to comment, too, but you beat me to it on the track listing. We've talked about this before on when we do album reviews. Track listings can kill an album or they can really make an album flow. And I think this track listing is spectacular. And we'll talk about that too, the order of them.
This song is about drugs.
You're probably right. I mean, it's grunge. Everything was about drugs.
Yeah, I don't think there's anything contrived about the lyrics or the delivery at all either. It seems too authentic. You know what I mean? Well, the next track is slotted perfectly in a perfectly sequenced album is Nearly Lost You. Fucking perfect song. Two episodes back we did singles, so I got into it there, so I'll keep my thoughts short and kind of turn it over to you. But yeah, I think I mentioned it just a little while ago, it might have been off mic, but I think the album actually got hurt by its appearance. This album probably sold less because this song was on that soundtrack. And if you're someone like me who had minimum, you know, limited funds to spend on this stuff, you were in college, you probably weren't buying every CD that came out. If I have to choose, this has Pearl Jam's new stuff, a new Alice in Chains song that I love, some Soundgarden, plus I get this killer song by a band that I otherwise don't know. I'm going to probably lean towards that, and I think this might have actually hurt this record as opposed to had they just released it just for this album.
That's an interesting theory that you have on the song, because I think what happened with me in Screaming Trees, I kind of have the exact opposite. So I had never heard anything by the Screaming Trees until we kind of just, you know, buried ourselves in the single soundtrack in college. Excuse me. And Nearly Lost You was just a standout track. And like you said, I have written down here too, maybe the most perfect song of that era, maybe the most perfectly written grunge song. The song should have been an absolute monster of a song. But because I love that song so much on the single soundtrack, that actually made me go out and seek Sweet Oblivion.
Okay.
So when we were in college, we went to college down in like Southern Mass, and we would on the weekends we would take trips into downtown Boston, and we would find these used CD places where they would have, you know, a lot of used stuff, a lot of stuff from you know, record labels, you know, reject things or whatever, mm-hmm. you know, producer versions or whatever. And I remember picking up Sweet Oblivion, and we listened to it on the ride home. It was probably about a 35-minute ride home to back to college. And everyone was like, holy fuck, this band is not just Nearly Lost You. Listen to this whole album. We just couldn't believe that we didn't know anything about this band because the album was so spectacular. And this song is just amazing. And there's a little bit of a funny story behind this too. So Van Conner, Gary Lee's brother, and Mark Lanegan were on a road trip, and apparently Mark was like on some kind of acid trip during it. So people like, well, is the song really about what people think it's about? You know, where I nearly lost you, and you know, I nearly lost you, it's taken us somewhere. I nearly lost you there. Let's try to sleep now. Maybe it is about an acid trip. Who knows?
Yeah.
I thought that was kind of interesting, but again, just Mark's voice, just spectacular. And the guitar, like for me, Mark Lanegan and Barrett Martin stand out here, but you can't sleep on the guitars. It's just such an interesting sound. There's really no like riffs, quote unquote. It's just like these chordal patterns and these changes that they're doing, and a lot of like noisy guitar sounds. And it's just spectacular. And I think this song is just so great. If I could give it 6 sleeveless flannels, I would, but I'll stick with 5.
Okay. Well, you're allowed, as I've done in previous episodes. Yeah, this is 8 sleeveless flannels for me. I hadn't heard it in so long, and it, you know, probably within 2 notes of it, I'm like just already like, yeah,
yep.
You know, it's just one of those things that just takes you back, and you know, which is the great thing about music in general. But yeah, this is a killer tune. It's a perfect 5. So
yep, absolutely.
Well, up next is Dollar Bill.
Torn like an old dollar bill.
Another song that was kind of a mild hit, and it's a different tone, obviously, from Nearly Lost You, which is kind of like an upbeat song.
This was a single then? I don't recall this tune at all.
I don't know if it was actually released as an actual single, but I know that after Nearly Lost You became very popular, mm-hmm. that I started hearing this a little bit on alternative rock radio, so it must have been released as a single. Either that or the radio started doing what they want. I don't know. But I started hearing this a lot. And I like how they changed it up with going with Nearly Lost You, which is an upbeat kind of rocker, and then you got this real melancholy, sad, emotional song, and you again, you can hear the pain in Mark's voice, and it almost reminds you of something. It almost gives you a vibe, a grungy vibe of like, you can't always get what you want by the Rolling Stones.
Oh, I like that.
Especially in the chorus, you kind of feel that from him, and it's almost like he's singing about, he feels bad that he's going to hurt someone and he doesn't want to do it, but he has no choice. He has to do what he needs to do, and he's going to end up hurting somebody. He just doesn't want to do it.
What's
and
that it's line? Kinda, I was trying to make it easy on you or something like that.
Trying to make it easy on you. Yeah. Try to make it better, make it easier on you. It's all I came to do.
There's so much soul when he sings that line, man.
It there really is. Yeah. It's just a great song. You're going to hear a lot of this from me, but I give this one another 5.
Okay. Lyrically, I think it's about breaking up with a stripper.
No.
That's where the dollar bill comes in. Yeah.
Either that or maybe he ran out of dollar bills and he's just saying, I'm sorry, I don't mean to hurt you, I just don't have any more.
He's got to leave Sniffer's Row because his drink is empty and he's out of ones. Yeah, this song, you summed it up perfectly. It's a great track. 3.5 rip flannels for me. Or sleeveless flannels.
Plus, before we move on, anytime you can throw a line in here, like, goodbye, mama, I've taken this too far. And yeah. He pulls off the mama.
Oh, yeah.
You know, he pulls that off great. But, yeah, good tune for me for sure.
All right. Well, up next is More or Less.
Us home. Gotta go that deep river where the water's moving slow. Feels like there's nothing to explain.
One of the things that I took out of this, and it's a very grunge or alternative thing, is to take something like a title like More or Less, you know, and it means absolutely nothing. You know, it's like it's almost a misdirection as a title. You know, I didn't research other examples, but they're out there.
This is my first four on the album. And for an album that's full of standouts, this is still a good song. But this is when you get really, really slow and really dark and very, very, you know, painful. I mean, Dollar Bill had that, but at least the chorus kind of lifted you up a little bit. This song really doesn't go there. It doesn't really go anywhere. The entire song is kind of very somber. The standout thing for me on this are the guitar tones. You know, some of those screeching and wailing tones that they're using on this are just a standout. And Mark's voice, again, we're going to keep saying he can just make any song sound great. But this is a painful song. For, you know, now that we've run this road so many times, tonight it will not take us home.
Yeah.
You know, when a song starts off like that.
Drugs.
Right. Exactly. But it's the Screaming Trees, and it's a song that I like. It's on this album and I like it, but I'll give it my first four.
Do you have the lyric in front of you that where that line more or less is used?
Yes, I do. It is. He says, feels like there's nothing to explain, nothing left to hear. One more or less, it's all the same. Mm-hmm. Now that it's feeling so much colder, coming back again, just be glad that it's all over.
And the phrase more or less is a pretty common term, which does not mean anything close to what he's saying there. So, you know, it's clever wordplay, you know. Coming from Minnesota, we got it. Paul Westerberg is classic at that. And then you got, of course, Kurt Cobain was one of the best at that, too. But that came in. We're on the same path up and down, but I'm a little lower than you. A 2.5. This song I really didn't care for that much. For pretty much the reason you said, it just kind of slugs and slows down. This is probably the only song on the record that I would skip if I went back, you know, going back to listen to it again.
Yeah, if I had to skip a song on this album, which I would not, then this would, but this would probably be it. I agree with you. Yeah, it's a little much.
Well, nice turnaround on track 5, though. Butterfly, one of my favorites on here.
So they bring you down with Dollar Bill and More or Less, and they pick you right back up with Butterfly. Upbeat, great chorus. It could have been a hit. You know, when you look at an album like Nevermind, and you look at an album like Pearl Jam 10, you know, there were singles upon singles upon singles. And you know, getting back to, I don't know if it was the record label or whoever, but this is a song that could have been a hit, and you could have heard it on the radio, and you could have gotten sick of it, or you could have loved it. But this is hit type grunge right here. More great tones from the guitars. You know, the guitars just stand out here. It's just a great song. I definitely give this one a 5. Yeah. And it's funny because when you look at the lyrics, the song, the tone of the song and the chorus and everything, it's kind of like, oh, it's an upbeat song.
Drugs.
Right. But then you hear cry, you know,
good
cry,
drugs.
cry, butterfly. I'm sick and I want to go home. Up to an empty room, four walls around, nothing to be found. You know, it's like he's kind of tricking you into, you're listening to the song, but then when you listen to the words, you're like, wait a minute, this is not that upbeat of a song. He's kind of messing here with my emotions as I hear the music and hear the words.
I like when an artist does that, though. It kind of tries to deliver. I mean, even, you know, guys like Elton John and John Lennon were classic for, you know, just beautiful songs about very depressing shit or things of that
Absolutely.
Nature.
Agreed.
This, you know, a lot of grunge albums have kind of a wintry or a fall feel to them. I don't know if you equate to music like that, but this might be the first grunge album that I actually felt like this actually is kind of a good summer record. I crank this up in your backyard patio or while you're driving down the freeway or something, just, you know, slamming beers down the I-94 free turnpike or something. But anyway, don't drink and drive, kids.
No, but I agree with you. I hear what you're saying. It's a kick-ass rock album.
Yeah. This one comes in a solid 5 for me. Did you already rate it?
I did. I gave it a 5 as well. Yep.
And side one closes out with For Celebrations Past.
This is for footsteps approaching the night. They keep themselves moving and do what is right. Now watch what you gather and hold in your hand. The numbers are many misunderstand. Your wine away instead. I won't remember all that said. Say farewell and close the door. You'll find me nevermore. And I believe in. And I believe in. That I believe in you. Must be a kind change.
This is a standout for me. Barrett Martin, again, just killing it on his drums here. Great song. You know, when Mark is screaming, you know, must be a crying shame. You know, that's just such a great, another song with a great chorus in the tones of his voice and the ranges that he can get. You know, I'm not going to compare him to somebody like Cornell because Cornell's voice is completely different. But the range that Mark is hitting on these songs, you know, and the way he just wails away, you know, at the very end of the song, when he's saying, I believe in you must be a cry in shame. And he's just wailing. He's just pouring out his soul on this song. And I think he does that with a lot, you know, another great line, you know, the numbers of many who misunderstand, drink your wine away instead. I won't remember all that said. Say farewell and close the door. You'll find me nevermore. And then it just takes off. It's just a great song. Just very passionate singing and songwriting by Mark.
Well, before we get into side two, let me ask you this. You clearly still go back to this record and you got into it, but this was your gateway to Screaming Trees. Did you dive deep into their whole catalog?
I have Dust. I have Uncle Anesthesia. Those albums are good. They're not Sweet Oblivion. What I did really enjoy was they did put out a compilation called Oceans of Confusion, which is spectacular because it has a couple of unreleased songs on it. And for anybody out there that's interested in looking up Screaming Trees and their catalog, they have 3 unreleased songs that I think they only appear on this compilation. They are 3 of their best songs. Like they could have easily been on Sweet Oblivion.
Do they say what era that was from, or?
I think they were written in that era because I think they wrote, if I recall correctly, I think they wrote a lot of songs during the Sweet Oblivion sessions. And I think those 3 songs that didn't make it, I think those songs I'm referring to, I think they're from that session. But if you're interested in Screaming Trees and maybe you don't want to get Sweet Oblivion, or maybe after hearing this episode, you'll fall in love with it. But I would recommend Oceans of Confusion. It encompasses their entire career as long as a handful of unreleased tracks, including three just standouts.
There was a large gap from when this album came out. It was like 4 years before the follow-up Dust came out. Do you know much about like what happened? Was there any type of turmoil? I mean, Mark Lanegan has his own, you know, history with drug abuse, like almost any talented person from Seattle does. Was it that? Was it brothers fighting? I don't know.
I think it was a combination of, one of the problems with the band on some of the things I read about was Sweet Oblivion was their high point. And when you're riding the wave, you got to put another album out right away. Mm-hmm. You got to, especially in this
right,
era.
That's kind of where I'm going. I'm like, what happened?
Right. And they didn't. I think that was a product of Mark's issues. I think it was a product of songwriting, record label issues, because Dust is a great album. It's not as good as Sweet Oblivion to me, but you got to think if they put Dust, you know, because Pearl Jam 10 comes out in 91 and then 2 years later they put out Verses,
right?
And they kept their fans, you know, with their music. If Dust had that ability, maybe they could have stayed on that track. But I think those 4 years in between, because of the turmoil that they had, I think with Mark and with the record label, I think that just spelled, unfortunately, the end of them. Now there are songs that were released back in, I think it was 2011. And they were all these songs. It's actually called Last Words, The Final Recordings. And I believe this was put out by Barrett Martin, if I recall correctly. If I'm wrong on that, you can correct me. But it's a collection of songs that were written and recorded that were just never put out. A record label just never took them. It's kind of a weird collection of songs. It's not something that I listen to often, but again, if you're interested in jumping into their catalog, it's called Last Words, The Final Recordings, and it's a kind of a long collection of songs that just never made it onto a regular studio album.
Yeah, I mean, I had to kind of focus on this record for the preparation of this, but I definitely walked away with the idea, like, I'm going to be checking out more of their stuff, because...
Absolutely,
Lanegan is just, I mean, he's just such a fun guy to listen to sing, but the music, you know, this is a really good to great record. I'll save further detail for my summary, but, you know, so I haven't got there, it's really all I'm getting at, so I'll definitely be taking your advice and checking that stuff out, and the Barrett Martin record as well, but... What about Did Grunge Kill Hair Metal? Where do you stand on that?
Oh, I know this is a common question that people love to answer different ways. I don't think grunge killed hair metal. I think hair metal killed hair metal. I think, you know, around 90, 91, I think the oversaturation, I think bands like Pretty Boy Floyd killed hair metal, you know, things like that. You had Britney Fox, you had, you know, Vinnie Vincent Invasion, who I like some of Vinnie Vincent Invasion. Yeah. I love All Systems Go. I love that. But I think it's just like, it's the same thing that
Vinnie had imploded his career 3 years before grunge.
That is true. That's true.
Come on.
But I think it's the same thing that when, if you want to say what killed grunge, it's the flavor of the month. So mm-hmm. you have this just saturation of band trying to do the same thing, and it comes off fake and phony and contrived, and it's not real, and people can see through that and they don't want to listen to it. You know, then you got a band like Tesla, one of my all time favorites. It pisses me off that they're thrown into that hair metal genre, but whatever, so be it. Mm-hmm. But you got bands like that were putting out great, they're still putting out great records now in 2019, 2020. But they kind of
survived during that period.
They did. But I think
Acoustical Jam was their biggest record, and that was right at the height of all this.
And I think the reason they survived is because they were writing quality songs with quality musicians with a quality vocalist.
Yeah.
You didn't have them trying to pretend to be something like a lot of these other bands. And I think that's what killed grunge, if you want to say what killed grunge. You had all these post-grunge bands that came out. They were trying to sound like Eddie Vedder. They were trying to sound like, you know, Kurt Cobain. But getting back to your original question, did grunge kill hair metal? No, I think it was just a confluence of things. You had the Use Your Illusion albums, you had the Black Album, you had a bunch of different things going on, and I think people were just kind of exhausted with hair metal and ready to try something new. I don't really think hair metal just kind of played itself out.
Yeah, I think thematically, hair metal ran out of lyrical content. You know what I mean? It was just where the bands you mentioned, you know, GNR, Metallica, you know, before grunge broke, they were starting to rise up. Tesla, they were writing about things that I think were more relatable. As much as people like to disappear into music and think, you know, and think about how great it would be to be riding a Harley down Sunset Strip with, you know, two strippers, you know, all coked up and giving you a blowjob. It's just not a real scenario, you know. And so I think that's a big part of it too. We actually, one of our earlier episodes, we got into this topic on kind of a side part, and much like you did, I answered loose. I was like, I'll tell you what killed grunge, and then I listed off about 10 bands like Pretty Boy Floyd, Firehouse, yep. All like, just like, yep. Tough, you know, all these bands. That's what fucking killed tough. It. Grunge did God. The classic movie mistake. They walked into a room where a dead body was, and they picked up the gun, and so their fingerprints were on it.
That is a perfect analogy. I've never heard that. That's true. Their fingerprints were on the murder weapon, but they didn't pull the trigger. It's true. That's excellent. No, you're right. I agree. Good one.
All right. Well, side two kicks off with Secret Kind. Skillful songwriting. Again, at this point, I'm starting to realize that I missed out on this record kind of back in the day. For whatever reason, this was right up my alley. This would have been played while I was, you know, getting, you know, drunk with friends playing Nintendo nonstop. This would have been in there with that whole collection of records I was playing. But no hidden message on this one.
No hidden message.
And one thing that I noticed that started hitting me, you know, now that I'm literally focusing on these records, a lot of grunge bands do like a bit of a bass breakdown where they let the guitar either just kind of ring out, or and hair metal bands never really did that. They always kind of keep things a little tighter. Also, the compression is off the guitars and that kind of stuff, which to me gives a more organic sound. But this song has just that little bit behind that. And then, I mean, an actual killer solo, too, on this tune.
I totally agree with what you just said on that, especially that part where they let the guitar ring out. Mm-hmm. And I have written down here that bass line, yeah. as that guitar tone is ringing out and that bass line is just grooving. But this right here, I also have written down another Barrett Martin drum clinic. He is just going to town. And I said it before, it's not overbearing. It's not distracting. It fits. It fits the song. And, right. and I think that's interesting, because you hear a lot of people talk about, you know, I mean, I love Eric Carr, but you've heard some, you hear people criticizing Eric Carr's technique because people say, oh, there's a drum fill that he never didn't like. You know, that he just couldn't stand not to do a drum fill here or there. But I think Barrett Martin is just so skillful with the way he does his fills and that bass drum. And this song right here is just spectacular. Catchy chorus, another song that could have been a hit. And the guitars are just off the charts. This is definitely a five for me. More five sleeveless shirts for me.
Your closet's getting full. I got four sleeveless flannels on this. We're kind of in the same ballpark. I'm just a hair less of a fan, it turns out. And to the Eric Carr thing, people seem to have forgotten him because he's been out of the band so long, you know, with his passing. But Eric Singer just isn't in the same league as him. Eric Singer is a studio musician. He is, and he's fucking very good. Don't get me wrong. That's not a shot at him. It's more of a compliment to Eric Carr. And also, one thing that the Barrett Martin and drummers like him, they do all this stuff without having that ginormous Neil Peart kit. You know what I mean? Like Eric Carr did. You know what I mean? He's got a fairly toned down 5 or 7 piece kit somewhere in that area, if I recall. But I haven't actually dug it up. But yeah, he does a fabulous job on Mad Season as well. And it's a very different style of music, so that it required something different. But the fact that he was able to fit that perfectly, you know, it just shows you a little bit of his talent. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. Yeah.
And he's a total ass for not wanting to come on the show. Fuck you.
I know. We're praising him right now. We're going to have to edit this now. But
he's listening to this, and just before that line, he's like, I'm going to get back to the, oh, that motherfucker.
Yep.
Won't be the first time I sabotaged myself, but yeah. So yeah, and a great second side opener too.
Absolutely. Oh God, yeah. Perfect opener.
And like I said, this is a great summer album. No summer album is complete without a song called Winter Song.
Jesus knocking on my door late last night, early this morning. Window glass rusted and wearing. I went straight. Seven precious flies bring you around. It's easier when I'm wasting my time and I'm losing my mind. Oh, my mind. Trying to wait for the sky to fall. It's kind of hard now to see it all. Whisper a song of winter.
So this song right here, we've talked about a lot of songs that I love. This song, without a doubt, is the best song on the album. If I could give it the highest rating, a 6, a 7, or a 10, I would do that.
Tom, I'm giving you the freedom. Do what you want.
I'm going to give it a 10. I'm going to, because this song, the chorus. It's the thing that stands out about this song is that we've gone through all these other songs where the guitars are ringing and wailing, the drums are going crazy, everything's happening. Then you get this song, and it's just a simple beat, a simple guitar tone. Mark's voice just carrying you, taking you on this little journey throughout this song. There's nothing overpowering about the song at all at any time. Way back when, in the early days of Napster and LimeWire, back in the good old days when you could steal music.
Right.
I found an acoustic version of this song, and it was just mind-blowing. I mean, as great as this, I don't even know where that came from because I can't find it. I tried to find it for this. I still can't even find it. But it was funny because this song, Mark Lanegan's voice gives me goosebumps pretty much throughout this entire album. Yeah. But when he comes across with that line, whisper some winter in your heart, it's just, I don't know. It's the combination of the words and the way he says it. He's letting his voice just do all the work throughout the song. And it was funny because I read an article about this album, and the person that was talking about this album, they said that if Nirvana did this song, if Kurt Cobain was singing this song and Nirvana did a song, it probably would have been the biggest grunge hit in the world. He said it's anthemic. The song is so good that he couldn't believe that it had never been written before by anybody else. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of why I love this album too, is that it's almost like the little album that could or couldn't, unfortunately. It's such a great album. And, you know, that's why I wanted to jump on the show with you, because I love talking about albums that I love that just don't get their fair shake. You know, so I'm hoping that after people listen to this episode, people will like what they heard and pick it up and get into the Screaming Trees. And this is one of those songs, I think, that kind of sells the album and just really puts it in its place.
Agreed 100%. And it's a love song, too, right?
It is. It is. And Mark pulls it off.
Melancholy.
It is. It's a painful song. You know, it's, you know. Just a roll of the dice and a precious vice bring you around. It's easier when I'm wasting my time and I'm losing my mind, you know? And then I like this line too. Dead end street, just out my back door. I heard what seen a young girl laughing. You know, he just the way and his voice. Oh, I just love it. He's just terrific.
You gave it 10. Although I'm going to try to find that acoustic track myself now. I would be interested to hear that. I like it. I think it's a really good song, but I gave it 3.5 sleeveless flannels. So
okay.
Well, the next track, Troubled Times, a little more my cup of tea.
Thank you.
I was worried this was just going to be a song, you know, like when it starts off, that it was just going to be one of those songs that ends up being 9 minutes long, and it's just this unnecessary, lazy, jammy thing. But didn't even get a minute into it before the fucker kicks in, and boy, what a killer track.
Totally agree, and I think that's the thing that makes this song stand out is it tricks you in the beginning. It sounds like it's going to be this kind of like, you know, moody, and it is moody, but it's this kind of moody, slow, kind of epic type of song. And then all of a sudden you get that little second pause, and then the drums kick in, and then you're like, wait a minute, what's going on here? And the song just takes off, and the chorus, just Mark's voice just soars, you know, when he's singing, you know, Troubled Times. This is an album throughout a lot of these songs, and I've mentioned this before, it's an album that when you're listening to the music and Mark's singing in the lyrics, you can feel the album. You know, this is not a Kiss album.
Woman!
This is not, you know, this is not, you know, put your hand in my pocket and grab onto my rocket. You know, that's there's none of that going on here.
Yeah, but that record you can play at home and feel it a different way.
Good point.
that is true. That is true. But I love how there's a little bit of a breakdown near the end of the song, picks up and then it slows back down. So the song starts and ends the same way.
Mm-hmm.
And I like that. I like how it has that intro and that outro. And then in between, you kind of have that song that really kind of kicks you in the teeth.
What do you give it?
Oh, I give it a 5.
Okay. It's 4 for me. Okay. Up next at track 10 is No One Knows. Song, but you can kind of feel the record starting to wrap up here.
Absolutely, I agree. Yep. I put No One Knows, Troubled Times, and More or Less kind of in that same group. More or Less is not as good as Troubled Times and No One Knows. This is a song that I really like the background vocals on this. I think the background vocals are kind of not really noticeable too much throughout the album. I think they're noticeable and I think they're good in this one. And I think on a song like this, we've talked about it before, I think when Mark is singing, I think he's sharing a lot of his pain. And I think that when he's sharing his pain, I think it's different from when you listen to like Dirt by Alice in Chains. Lane Staley is just telling you how much pain he is in, and he doesn't really care what you think about it. It's almost like Mark is sharing his pain, and he wants you to know that he's in pain. And maybe, you know, it's a different kind of emotion that he conveys. And I don't know if that's his voice or the lyrics, but you know, the same thing with Chris Cornell, you know, all these guys, they sing about pain and their voices carry that. But I think this album and his vocals, it's pain, but it's not like hopeless pain, if that makes any sense.
Mm-hmm.
Like Dirt to me, I've hopeless. Said this to Zeus, at the end of Dirt, you may find yourself addicted to heroin yourself when you're done listening to that album. I mean, it's a spectacular album. I mean, it's a spectacular album, but you're not like this album. You might put on at a party. You're not putting Dirt on at a party.
No.
But I like this song. I'm going to give this one a 4. This is another 4 for me.
Excuse me.
This is a forgettable tune. I'm even trying to remember it in my head.
Okay.
But I wrote down, I gave it a 3, so I like it a little bit better than that one song I gave 2.5. But, you know, back to the Lane Staley thing, how are you familiar with the Mad Season record as far as the lyrics and stuff of that?
I am, yeah.
Okay, very much the same thing with Dirt. And we talk about it in the episode, Aaron and I do, but like how self-aware, like this guy is, you know, because it's one of the biggest things with addiction is denial. I mean, this guy just never had it. You know what I mean? He was like, he's just like, no, I'm a fucking junkie. Don't listen to me because I'm gonna lie, and I'm probably going to be dead. And even then, Jerry Cantrell's solo record, Degradation Trip, it's almost, I thought it was about Lane until we got into that record, but it's almost, it's like Dirt Part 2.
Yep, where it really is.
It's just fucking dark, and it's like, yeah, I'm a loser on drugs all the time, you know, and it's weird that they can be so painstakingly honest and also be unable to correct any of this obviously bad behavior that they're acknowledging is going to kill them, you know, like the will to live. Didn't surpass the addiction, you know what I mean? And that just says a lot about the problems with addiction. But
it's true. When you talk about Dirt, and that's kind of like almost in a different way of what I was saying, was that, you know, Lane Staley, he's telling you, like, mm-hmm. I'm in pain. But he doesn't care really what you think. He's just telling you because, you know, yep, this is me. I'm an addict. Right. I'm a junkie. There's nothing I can do about it. There's nothing you can do about it. But, you know, maybe you like these songs that I'm singing to you about it.
And the lyrics on this record have that similar tone and delivery, but like you mentioned, there is more of a hopefulness.
There really is.
In what Mark Lonergan sings. As dark as some of this shit is,
yep.
You kind of come with the idea that, like, you know, there's a chance he's going to crawl out of this. You know what I mean?
Yep. But, agreed.
The record closes with Julie's Paradise.
Hey, dog, hearts in the night. No wrong or right. Hey, dog, hearts from the heat. I need sugar sweet. I need some machine. Says I'm gonna run my mind. Inside, I'm thinking paradise. All that I want, and a little water, and a little water. Something's gone wrong in my mind. Something's gone wrong inside.
Talked about Shadow of the Season being a great opener. What a spectacular closer of a song here. I've talked about it throughout the entire album here, and I'm going to say it again because the last song, Barrett is an absolute monster on this song. I mean, there are so many times where I will just find myself playing like air drums just to this without even realizing I'm doing it. It's just an epic song. Mark takes off. And Barrett just is going crazy. I think it's a great ending. And I read a great quote when I was looking up some research for this album. And they said that the finale sounds like it's a band that has given everything throughout the entire album and is finished lying in a heap of their own emotion.
Oh boy.
And I think that is like such a great way to say it, because the way the song ends, it's like they just, it's the last song. We got nothing left. Here it is.
I wrote down that's a good closer to a great album. I'm good to great. I think I have to spend more time with it to give it that official Baco stamp of greatness. But yep. I have this at 4.5 Sleeveless Flannels. Where did you go?
I gave this probably a 5.5 to a 6. I think the song is great because it's the last song and it's almost like, you've been on this entire emotional journey with the band through this entire album, mm-hmm. the ups and downs, the sadness, the pain. And it's like, it's all over. It's almost like if you ever see like in a movie, you know, or when somebody is like bawling their eyes out and when they're done, they just exhaust, they got nothing left. It's almost like that's what this song is. You just kind of ending it and say, we got nothing left. Here you go.
And that vinyl you bought, is that a recent, or like a reissue pressing?
It came out in 2015. Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Sound good?
It sounds amazing. Oh God, it sounds great. And the liner notes, it's got a gigantic essay written by Barrett Martin from 2015. And if you don't mind, I'd like to read a little section here since we reached the last track.
Absolutely.
Barrett kind of wraps it up and he says, when I listen to Sweet Oblivion today, I hear the rise and fall of the tempos, the ferociousness of the musical delivery, and the emotional tension and release of the songs. Mark's vocal howl and roar with the wisdom of a man much older than the 20-something he was. He tells stories that are both majestic and spiritual, as well as haunting and ephemeral. Gary Lee's guitar work is highly original and inspired, even brilliant in places. And the rhythm section work of Van Conner's bass and my drumming makes the band swing like a battleship on the high seas.
I would have loved it if he went through all that and then just ended and Van Conner played bass.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
I love poking fun at bassists and drummers, but
just a great description because it's kind of like what we talked about, the ups, the highs and lows and the emotions of the album.
The sequencing, you know, when you have this level of material is very key to kind of, even though it's not a concept album, you need to kind of like track this properly. And you were saying that track 6 was actually listed as a bonus track on the vinyl and the CD.
It is, because when I was reading it, when I was doing some work on this, people kept referring to For Celebrations Past as a bonus track. And I was like, well,
middle.
Right. Usually bonus tracks, obviously, are at the end. And I looked at my CD and I looked at the vinyl and they both have a little asterisk and they say bonus track. And I said, well, when did this not, like, because every copy of every version of this album I have has For Celebrations Past. And thank God they do have it because it's a standout track for me. But I thought that was interesting. And you're right. It's in the middle of the album, not at the end.
I don't remember that specifically, but there's so many examples of it's like, where you would see an album released in the late 80s, early 90s, where they would say bonus track, but it would be on every version of the release.
Right.
I think even that with the Skid Row one comes to mind, isn't that Midnight Tornado listed as a bonus track? I can't remember for sure, but the last track on their debut album, I swear to God, was listed as a bonus. But
yeah.
I like to give the final thoughts to the last word on the album to the guests. So I'll share mine real quick. One, this is definitely going to end up in my physical collection at some point. I do enough used CD shopping that I'm going to stumble across this fucker and it'll go. And I'm actually thinking about getting the vinyl now that you were flashing it around and being all cocky with it in front of me. Now I have FOMO, so I have to go on Amazon right after we talk here and order it right away. I'm probably going to get two copies just to outdo you. and I don't know if you knew this, but Mark just released a solo album.
Yes, Mark Lanigan. Yeah, he has a solo career. I'm glad you brought that up. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah,
but we can touch on that in a minute. But as far as this album, I think there's enough good to great material on here that this should be revered more. I now get why it's on this list, and I've talked on this a lot. And we'll get to your rankings here in just a minute after you talk on this. But I think for, you know, a lot of these lists, they're very clickbaity and they throw in shit. Like I saw a Motley Crue record list that somebody shared today ranking all their albums and they had Girls, Girls, Girls at number 2, which to me is just a total troll thing. It's like, come on. This list, even though some of the stuff I don't personally like I don't like Nevermind. I will never go back and listen to it, but I know why it's number 1.
To have Nevermind, I don't mean to cut you off,
yeah, that's right.
But to have Nevermind number 1 on a grunge list, it's the equivalent of having, you know, Rolling Stone rank the Kiss albums and putting Destroyer number 1.
Right.
It's just basic.
Exactly.
Like, oh, it's just basic. But I mean, I like Nevermind, but I have it ranked fairly high, but I don't have it number 1.
Why don't you give me your final thoughts on this album as a whole? Touch on anything that we didn't cover, anything you wanted to get into.
It's just, as you can tell, my passion throughout this episode. I've been pouring over this album because I don't have a chance to talk about this album because no one has it. You know, as the song title says, no one knows. Mm-hmm. You know, I was thrilled to see it on this Rolling Stone list. Rolling Stone is usually complete shit. coming from a Kiss fan, you can see why. Mm-hmm. But to see it ranked 17th, I was very, very impressed and happy with that. You know, I like rooting for albums that I love, and to see it 17 was good. It's just a very important album to me. It's an album that I consistently listen to. You know, my wife hears me playing it so much in college and now that she's a big fan of a lot of the songs. You know, she loves Butterfly and Nearly Lost You and, you know, just great songs. I know Zeus is a fan, not as big as me. My college roommate loves this. You know, it's a great album. And I think more people need to give the Screaming Trees a shot. They just had a very muddled career, and they could have been huge, and they just weren't. And it's just too bad.
Yeah, I mean, they had some image issues without poking fun at them, you know what I mean? You know, kind of hard to sell, even with grunge, which was basically no image, it was tough. But no, are you out of the Boston area like Zeus is?
I grew up, me and him grew up next towns next to each other.
Do me a favor, say, where can I park my car?
I am not saying that because that is, nobody says that. And here's another thing, nobody calls Boston Beantown. The only people that do that are the people that are not from there.
Tell it to the Wahlbergs, asshole. That's where I fucking heard it from.
Fuck those guys. Yeah, those guys are fucking clowns. Yeah. By the way, it's funny. You're from Minnesota.
Don't you know?
This might be weird. Huge, lifelong Vikings fan.
Really?
Yes.
I had no idea.
I'm a diehard Patriots fan, but the Vikings have always been my second team. And I think one of the most devastating losses in my entire life was that 98 NFC Championship game with Gary motherfucking Anderson. He made every field goal and every extra point all year and misses that field goal. They would have cruised that best team to never win a Super Bowl.
Yeah, you don't have to tell me. I was at that game. And
brutal.
My seats were kind of like corner end zone, and it was that end zone. And I'm on the opposite side of that it missed. So it kind of looked like it went in. And there was like this 2 or 3 seconds where the crowd didn't know, like, I think we just won. And then, although that went to ice the game, but it would have put it pretty much out of reach for Atlanta. I think we would have gone up by 10 instead of they were able to tie it with us missing the field goal. Yeah, what a fucking crusher.
Brutal.
Man. But, you know, that's what sports is all about, I guess. Apparently, I'm a glutton for punishment being that they're my team. But that's interesting to know, man. I'll have to start texting you during football games. I do like to talk a lot of shit, but I really like to talk about the game. But
Excellent.
I'm not a Patriot hater like a lot of people. I do get sick of one team being good all the time, but the combination of, even though like there's some shady shit going on, it's more along the lines of like if you found out a college you hate paid a player, well, so did your team, okay? Yeah, I think the things that they're guilty of, they might have just been a little more effective at it than other people. I don't get honestly, the ball deflating thing, I don't even understand why we talked about it.
Because it was Brady.
Brady and Belichick, I just like the way they've kind of handled themselves. But I've never experienced this, so maybe I would feel differently. But I got to believe that unless it's the Minnesota Vikings, I don't really want to see one team all the time. But the weird thing is that, like, I hate the fucking Lakers. I hate the Yankees. And I hate the Cowboys. And the Cowboys have sucked for about 20 years, but I still ain't letting that go.
Yep.
But for whatever reason, I just never got... The Patriots are more like the Bulls to me. I never really got angry with the Bulls. I was just like, when you got that one guy who kind of leads everything, and it's just hard to really kind of blame him for just being better than everybody else with Jordan and then with Brady. But you know, now that we've pissed people off talking about sports, but...
They can deal with it.
Yeah, fuck them. Anyway, welcome back to the Grunge Show. The Rolling Stone put it at 17. I only moved it up 2 spots. I have it at 15. Now, typically I ask, but you sent me your list, and you kind of have a logjam here. You got 3 records tied for the number one spot, this being one of them.
Yeah, so I have 3 records that are very important to me. It's this, Pearl Jam 10, and the single soundtrack. Single soundtrack, I'll bounce that out just because it's got a couple songs that I'm not a huge fan. I don't need that Jimi Hendrix song on there. You know, so that's,
you're going to like my take on that when that episode comes out then.
It's not that it's a bad song. It's just that I don't need it.
I'll go a different direction. It is a bad song. That song fucking sucks.
Okay.
Fuck Hendrix.
But for me, this and Pearl Jam 10 are going to be tied for me. If you put a gun to my head, I would probably put Pearl Jam 10 number one, but that would be by like the slightest fraction of a hair. But those right there for me are one and two, no doubt. 1A, 1B, however you want to say it.
Well, once again, Tom, thanks you for coming on. But I still don't know where I can park my car in Boston. I'm a little upset with that. apparently, there's no parking. how come you guys all hire Midwesterners to be your news anchors?
I don't watch the news at all, local, national, or cable, so don't talk to me about that.
The Shout It Out Loudcast can be found your weekly, and you have a special side episodes coming up. Way too much Poony, by the way.
He's a nice guy. He's a friend. We like him, and he's one of the few people that will tolerate. He's one of the few people that will tolerate me and Zeus for extended periods of time, so that's why we have him on repeatedly. I would love to know what he's saying behind our backs, but you know, when he's in front of us and on the mic, he's a great guy, and he adds a lot to the shows. But you know, his last name helps too.
No, I fucking love Sonny. He's literally one of the kindest people I've ever met. And until you start talking about his children, and then he's like kind of a dick dad, like won't let him have pets. You know, you're not getting a dog. Fuck you. Get up and grow up. And get your own damn house.
Oh, and he can be sneaky and pretty slippery too. Don't let him fool you if you don't know that about him already. Oh.
Nice.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
No, he's been nothing but gracious with us.
He's great.
Yeah, he's just. Have you met him
In person? Okay. No. Everything is over Skype with him.
That booming smile of his, literally, like you walk into a room and you know right away where he's at. Well, first of all, he's a giant.
Yep.
He's just a good guy. I love poking fun at him though. So thank you very much, Tom. Sweet Oblivion, I give it very highly recommend anybody that hasn't checked it out, check it out. I'm going to dig into more of the Screaming Trees stuff just because of the time I spent with this record. But thank you very much for agreeing to do this. You filled in a lot of the holes I didn't know. And of course, your relationship to the record, I think listeners will probably relate to, especially people who are fans of this album.
Thank you so much for having me, Baco. Great show. I love that you're doing this series. I look forward to these episodes. Like I said, grunge is just special to me. I still listen to it now, and it brings back memories. It's a very nostalgic genre of music. And being able to talk about this album top to bottom, inside and out, was just great for me, because probably not going to have another outlet to do it. So I'm glad I could contribute to your project here, and I was happy to talk about one of my all-time favorite albums.
And once again, check out the Shout It Out Loudcast. Even if you don't like Kiss, you'll enjoy this show.
Yes, please do. You do not have to like Kiss to like us. You might hate us, but whatever. You'll find out, but just check us out.
Well, I guess with that, let's just get out of here, man.
Whatever.
All right, never mind. And went off on me.
That's Zeus. Yep, yeah, that's him.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Fernino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune into Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.